Therapy Insiders is brought to you by Verve, makers of the Arc, a revolutionary neck pain relief and postural support device, available now at www.goarcnow.com, and by Edge Mobility System. Give your mobility the edge. Available at www.edgemobilitysystem.com.
Hello, welcome back to Therapy Insiders. I'm Dr. Gene Chirac-Abrad, here with Dr. Joe Palmer, Dr. Ursula Religioso, and joining us again, because he didn't have enough of us last time, is Dr. Barton Bishop. How's everyone doing?
Good, Gene.
We're doing awesome.
Doing well, Gene.
All right. Before we get started, I think we need to take a little minute and say happy birthday to our very own Dr. Joseph Palmer. He is celebrating his 17th birthday today, and he's almost a man. So, Joe, happy birthday.
Appreciate it, buddy. Thanks a lot. Happy to be here on my birthday.
Happy birthday, Doogie.
He is a boy genius, but the commitment, I hope everyone listening out there knows the commitment that he shares to do a podcast on his birthday. I mean, that's just, I can't even describe.
That's right. Listen to the end, damn it. None of you tune out early.
Yeah, that'll be your gift to Joe. Yes. I can tell you, I probably won't be doing this on my birthday.
You never know.
You bought my picture up. Yeah.
You never know. So we had a great time with Dr. B last time, and he enjoyed as well. So he's back, and we are glad to have him. And in honor of his coming back on the podcast, we decided to do an episode about nothing. How that relates to his honor, I'm not quite sure yet.
I am a big Seinfeld fan, and that was a show about nothing, and it was genius. It was pure genius.
So, well, yeah, we'll go with that, because he likes Seinfeld, I like Seinfeld. Urson, you like Seinfeld?
Yeah, I said tonight I'd be Art Vandelay.
And Joe,
you assign? I'm in. Let's do it.
All right. So here we go. We're going to do an episode about nothing. We might not be genius quite like Seinfeld, but we'll go with somewhat intelligent, maybe smart, and hopefully entertaining if all else fails. So I might as well get this out of the way. No soup for you. Okay. I feel better now.
Podcasting gold, Gene. Podcasting gold.
Hopefully we can save that for the end as well. So let's get the whole episode started with, I think, one of my favorite things as we've gone through these episodes with, and I don't know why, but it's mostly been Urson describing some of the biggest wipeouts or fails that he's had with patients. I don't know if it's just because you are so comfortable in describing these, but we've talked a lot about, you know, how we're good and things that we can do well, but we all know in the clinic just things happen. You know, you say things that you regret, or you just misjudge a situation, or you have a patient that's going to MD school that thinks he knows everything and wants a diagnosis, and you don't give it to him, and then he flips out on you and walks out and has his mom pay his bill. So either way, you know, whatever happens, things like that can be part of daily life. So let me throw it out to the peanut gallery. Joe, since it's your birthday, might as well start it off with one of your something that you remember, maybe that comes to mind, then go quite right. Might be a funny story, might not. What you got for us?
Pass.
Pass. Does that mean you've got none?
No, I don't have. It's a show about nothing. I'm just not prepared. I don't study and come prepared to air out my laundry on the podcast here.
It doesn't have to be laundry. It's just a funny situation that might have not gone quite as you would expect.
Yeah, I get the question.
Look, I'll start. So I've got one. So when I had first graduated, and mind you, I am an Uber PT because I have my doctorate in physical therapy, right? That makes me a genius, does
it
not? I mean, all of us. I mean, it's like it's a prerequisite. But I graduate, you know, and I'm working in this clinic and I'm seeing patients, and And it's, you know, it's such like a stupid thing, but as I first start to see this patient, this lady Eileen, I remember her like it was yesterday. She was, and is my boss's mother's like best friend growing up, and I'm working on her lateral hip, and for 2 months, I documented that I was working on her TFL and trying to release her TFL. I was doing like a myofascial release with an active component, if Mike Leahy's listening. And, you know, so I'm trying to release her TFL, and all of a sudden, about 6 months, 8 months, 2 years, I don't even know when later, I realized, oh my God, that was her glute min, not her TFL. And so for 2 months, I was actually, I was working where I was working, but I thought it was the different muscle. And that's when I realized that there is no PT that should be allowed to treat patients alone for their first year out of school because they might kill someone.
That is such a PT story. I mean, nobody else, if you say that to anybody else, they will look at you like, what are you talking about? What just happened?
It's not exactly like a party starter at any other party but ours.
Who's killed somebody by massaging their TFL?
Yeah, seriously.
Well, and the best thing is I was actually working on the glute min. I was just documenting it incorrectly. You know,
deserve the title of doctor.
That's right. That's right.
So you're basically rubbing this woman's ass for 2 months. 2 months?
Roughly.
Yeah, with an active component, though.
It was myofascial release with an active component, yes.
That's the key. Yeah. So yeah.
I did not do active release technique.
I'll tell you a funny story. I'm going to cheat. So it wasn't me, but I was next to the person that did this. So it's still funny and still funny to this day. And thankfully it was a good patient. So we had a little satellite clinic triathlete shop a few years ago. We saw a bunch of runners, swimmers, all the gang. And there was a couple of us or three of us usually there. And one of the therapists wasn't as adept at certain techniques. So he had a patient that the other therapist and I treated a couple times, but at that point I was treating another patient that was emergency treatment, and if you can call such a thing, but you know, triathletes, they got to get their training in. So this patient, whenever she was in pain, I don't know if you guys have ever seen this, but whenever you palpate or did anything and she felt pain, she would just start uncontrollably laughing, just giggling nonstop.
Yeah. So, I'm one of those.
Yeah, I had a patient call it a Herkel. It hurt tickles. She named it. It was a high school student, high school girl, of course. She called it a Herkel.
I'm definitely stealing that. So she was Herkeling, and so I turn around and he's examining her. So she had a hip restriction, and there's a hip manipulation where you lay the person down and you do like a glancing blow over the greater trochanter to improve posterior glide of the joint and anterior rotation. So you set the person up in sideline, you kind of flex the hip a little bit, flex the knee a little bit, so, and then internally rotate it a little bit so the greater trochanter is, you know, right there.
Exposed.
Yeah, if you can picture that. So what you do is you find the greater trochanter, you palpate, and then you do a quick glancing blow to improve that rotation. So what he does, and I'm, you know, I turn back a little bit. I'm watching my patient on the treadmill. I look back, see her on the sideline. I'm like, okay, he's gonna do this technique. And I turn back to my patient who's on the treadmill. Then all of a sudden, I hear smack and just uncontrollable laughing. This wasn't Herkeling anymore. This was just laughing, hysterical laughing. I turn around, and he's got his palm just five fingered right on her butt cheek. He completely missed the greater trochanter and just high-fived her butt. And she's there laughing, and he turns to me with just this look of pure nothingness on his face and just turns and says nothing. And he doesn't know which way to go. Did I do something terrible? Do I start laughing with it? So thankfully she was there a little bit before that, and she was okay with it. You know, obviously he said sorry and then redid the technique properly, but that was one of my funnier moments that I've seen in the clinic, and thankfully it was in a triathlete shop, because that gang of people are pretty laid back and go with the flow, and she had to really go with the flow.
I like it that it was your coworker, Gene.
Yeah,
let's air our dirty laundry. My coworker
Right.
Yeah, I don't First have of all, I don't believe story. In laundry. And second of all, it was my coworker, Joseph.
But if you've worked with triathletes, and this is the funny thing, you're right, they are laid back. But triathletes are, it's a special breed of human. You know, like an Ironman or a half Ironman triathlete. I mean, that is a special breed of human that is out alone for, I mean, 20 hours a week training alone, cycling, swimming, running. And I will say that every Ironman triathlete I've worked with pretty much fits that same mold of the ability, and maybe it's better for them to be alone for long periods of time. Nothing against that, just saying.
No, they're definitely a unique brand of people, even runners, long distance runners, or I see a lot of runners and it's the same thing. I mean, if I'm alone for that much time, I mean, I can barely stand myself for that much time. That's just a lot of thoughts that go through your head, and I need more interaction than just being by myself. But you know, we love runners, some of us more than others, right, Joe?
Some of us more than others, Gene.
How many marathons has Casey done now?
10 or 11, something like that.
Casey is Joe's beautiful and extremely nice wife. Casey, Casey, if you're listening.
Joe runs vicariously through.
I do. She does my running for me.
Oh, speaking of running, Joe, please tell your story again of the marathon and how you almost lost a finger.
That's neither here nor there. I did run one marathon, and that was enough for me. And it was in PT school. It was still while I was wooing my wife, and I had to do some crazy stuff. So we'll put that behind me.
You got it.
You know, the first person that ran a marathon, died.
Yeah, I know. And all of a sudden, someone just thought that would be a great thing to do.
Right, yeah, and then they started selling like bib numbers for it, and there you go.
Yeah, it became like the gladiators. You know, let's do this and see who'll survive.
Let me ask this. If you guys had someone come to you, just a normal everyday person, I like to say there are two types of people. There are those who run and there are runners, right? I'm a run. I run, but I'm not a runner. So if you had someone that came to you, and let's say they run, or let's say they don't run very much, and they said, you know what, I'd really like to run a marathon, what would you say to them? Would you say, yes, that's a great idea, and here's what you do? I mean, what would you say?
There's this group. I'm not sure if it's a national group, but there's something called Team in Training.
That's they're really national.
Popular. Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah, raise money for Lymphoma and Leukemia Society, yeah.
Yeah, I do think that they have a responsible training schedule, but their whole thing about anyone can run a marathon, I think, is not necessarily true. I mean, I used to see a lot of one of their coaches would just bring me a lot of their clients, and you know, some of them when I would just say, I don't think you can do this at this point, or if they're early on in training, it's fine. But if they only had 2 weeks left, and you know, they had a really hot knee, and they just really had to just kind of back off, I would have people just break down crying in front of me. And or there were just certain people also that were just so physically unfit, or they didn't sleep well, or they had a poor diet, and they just thought that they could run. I mean, there are just certain people I think who can't do it. I mean, I've always even thought that when I would always run like 5 or 10 Ks, but I thought, I just don't think I have it in me to run a marathon. I just don't think anyone can run a marathon. I don't know. I think it just depends on the individual.
To somebody that has that kind of running experience. I love the science of running. You know, I appreciate it. But playing sports, you know, baseball and football, running was a punishment. So running to me was sprints. Running to me was just more of the, you know, the quick twitch, get it done type of thing, more speed training. Long distance running, I've never enjoyed. Maybe 2 miles I'm good for, and that's about it. But I love, you know, I love studying and love seeing it and love fixing it. But I've had patients tell me, runners tell me, there had one patient who was literally sitting on his couch, finishing some kind of fast food, about to go for a cigarette, and he just kind of stopped in his tracks and just said, what am I doing to myself? Because his dad had a heart attack early on, and he said, I'm not doing it. And he started running, and you know, now he does long distance running.
I mean, Gene, I hear what you're saying. I think you have to get that experience somewhere, and I think that anybody can work towards that. But I don't think that people are prepared. I'm in Urson's camp. I don't think that when people want to do it, that they necessarily understand what is involved in running a marathon.
But that's like anything else. You know, people don't want to work out. People don't go to the gym. It's if you have a realistic expectation of what is to come, and sometimes it looks easier than it is.
And yeah, I mean, those people don't. I mean, they don't understand the time commitment that's involved with that kind of a endeavor to do it right. And if you do it wrong, you end up in our office. I mean, that's what I say. I say that if you're going to do it, you have to commit to it and do it right. You can't half-ass run a marathon.
Yeah,
right.
I think it's a spotlight. I think running is a big spotlight of if there's anything wrong in your body, right? Because you can function perfectly fine with aches and pains and H&Ps and all the other stuff. But once you start doing that repetitive motion over and over and over again with the ground reaction forces and everything that's involved, any small issue that you have will soon become a very big issue. So I think it also shines a spotlight on what issues you have.
I think it's also one of the few sports that people just go out and decide that they can do without any form of coaching or whatever. Like, people don't expect to be an amazing golfer by just picking up a golf club, but yet people just think they can strap on some running shoes and just do a half marathon or a marathon right away. I mean, you know, I like the, like my wife did a Couch to 5K program, and I think that's a really good program because it ramps you up, you know.
And that's a 5K.
Right, and it's a 5K.
It's a 40K. It's you know, and that's, I think that's a huge difference. I mean, I've run a few 10-milers. That's the longest that I've ever gone in any sort of running thing. And I think I've done 4 of them. And I just sit there and think. I mean, Joe, you've done 1 marathon, right?
Correct.
Now, as succinctly as possible, why didn't you want to do a second?
I didn't want to commit to doing another one. It was rough on my body. It was a big time commitment, and I was struggling with my own injuries through training, even following a schedule. So I mean, it's I have a great respect for people that are able to do it, but.
Plus, I told him I would not effleurage his legs for another 45 minutes afterwards. That was ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, what do we do, you know, as physical therapists, trusted medical practitioners? I mean, what do we do when our patients come to us? I mean, and talk about this? Because I think there's a component of everyone being right in this. You know, Urson saying not everyone can run a marathon. And Joe saying, well, maybe they can. I think it's, you know, I've worked with Team and Training for 10 or 12 years, and they do a nice training program, and they have a run walk group, and they have a run group, and they have a fast run group. But I mean, for me, I think when someone comes to me and starts talking about this, the first thing I think about is probably more along where Gene was going is a little bit more into the science of running. And I get into the whatever I can do to help them run better with running mechanics and running analysis and you know, because I'm not in the belief that running causes injuries. I think bad running causes injuries.
I think you also have to have a trusted network of referral sources, and not just referral sources as physicians or other PTs, but other groups as well, other running coaches that you know, golfing coaches, you know, other professionals that you can trust to send your patients to, personal trainers, wherever it is. You know, you can't be under the mindset that you will fix and have an answer for every single problem or issue. So if I get a runner that is more in the realm of learning the schedule of running or developing a routine for running, like Joe was talking about, knowing the commitment that it takes, I'll recommend a running coach that I really like, that I know is really good. Like Urson and I know Amanda at Ms. Zippy One on Twitter, and her blog, MissZippy1.com. I mean, she's fantastic, and she puts out great information, and I wouldn't think twice about if somebody asked me, hey, I want to start running. can you give me some information? I'd say, listen, check her out. She lives it. She'll give you a lot better information than I will.
I think that's a good point for anyone, runners or not. I mean, I have a short list of people that I would refer out to, and I tell patients that as well. I mean, you know, I always tell people that there's the majority of people, 80% of them or so, will have a rapid response, will be able to get, you know, significant changes in the first few visits. 20% will be more like the tortoise rather than the hare, but slow and steady will win the race. And you know, some people, PT is just not for you, but I have, you know, a short list of great providers that will see you without, you know, ancillary personnel, and, you know, their small offices and small businesses. And I would go to these clinicians or coaches if I had an issue. So, you know, I for me, I think it's important to present patients with an exit plan.
So this episode about nothing's quickly turning into an episode about running.
I know. That's why I tried to turn it away from running, because we do talk about running a lot. I love treating runners. And
it's an interesting topic with a lot of variables. So let me throw this out. This is obviously going to be divisive and people have their own opinions. But if you had to pick one joint, what would you say is the most important joint for a runner?
Didn't we already ask this?
I want to know. Running? I want to know again. One joint.
Are you back on the big toe kick? Jesus. I don't let the big toe go.
I don't need to get called out on the big toe. I want to know what everyone else
is
doing.
You mean other than the big toe?
Other than the big toe.
Did I already say contralateral shoulder and thoracic spine?
you can't ask what you said already.
Look, I work with chiropractors. It is absolutely the occipital atlanto joint. It is C0, C1. If you don't align that, everything goes to hell.
Well, that's for everything. It's not just for runners. Jeez.
Isn't that what hemorrhoids are caused by too, Bart?
Yeah, that's right. Stance hip.
T4.
Oh, okay. Stance hip. So you're saying the hip joint.
Well, I mean, are you talking the joint or the joint and muscular component around it?
A joint.
A joint, like an actual arthrokinematic movement within that where bone articulates with bone.
Yes. Yeah, thank you
joints.
For defining joint.
I only think movements, not joints.
I know. This is a joint that provides movement.
The knee. Tibiofemoral.
Okay. The knee.
And I'm going to say that because if it does not act as basically a pure hinge joint in the running gait, then there is going to be significant problems in the knee.
Okay.
I can't even just pick one joint. I mean, I just love to do slow motion running analysis from different angles and just, you know, pick apart their symmetry or their asymmetries. And it's really hard to say, but the great toe and the ankle are pretty big ones for me.
I'll accept the answer.
I'll go with the SI joint because, you know, I don't work with chiropractors, but I do feel like whether they start with a joint problem in another joint, they all end up with some kind of preference for their or some kind of rotation in their pelvis. Just an adaptive, I'm going to keep running, and their body finds a way to avoid the pain, and then they end up with an oblique pelvic alignment.
Yes, the old SI joint. I do like the SI joint for most things. I think it's involved somehow or another, not necessarily the cause, but I think it's a relieving factor. I feel like the SI joint might be our COC1 of the chiropractor. What do you think, Bart?
I'm with you on that. SI joint is there are three areas that provide us the most proprioception as well: sole, the foot, the SI joint, the cervical spine. So seriously, SI joint is huge.
I would disagree with all three of you, actually. I haven't looked at an SI in probably maybe 8 to 10 years. I'm a big McKenzie guy, and I just find, you know, I agree with what their research shows, and not even their research, but they often cite this research, that less than 10% of all lumbar cases are true SI after you rule it out with repeated motions and double-blind
Well, what is a true SI? I mean, true SI versus SI involvement in SI. I mean, you could see even in runners, if they have an SI involvement and they have segmental facilitation and they have overactivation of S1, S2, and the hamstrings or the gastrocs, a lot of times you either do repeated movements or you do proprioceptive input through mobilizations, you know, grade 3, grade 4 oscillations, and you see the tone go down and you see improvement in the motion overall. So pure,
right. Well,
sure, I mean, yeah, I can go along with that, but it's still treated.
Well, I still just think I'm treating any one area. I mean, I don't really treat obliquities, or do I even believe that mobilizations or MATs can change position? We can only change movement and perception of stretch, but we can't really change.
Seconded.
Yeah, we can't change, if you think something's posteriorly rotated and you do a mobilization and they move better and they feel better, we didn't really change the position of the bones. We might have changed tone. We can change tone of muscles, but I just don't like to think of anything as SI, because like what is traditionally taught as SI, like all these palpatory tests and supine to long sits and the Gilles test, like all those things are literally the worst. They have the worst sensitivity and specificity. So
how did the funny thing is that's a PT. When you say like traditional, you know, I obviously learned that in PT school, just like you all and like everybody else has. And, right. You know, the Jackson's technique and everything that came out of muscle energy, contract, relax, and, you know, that. And as I got into my group and my chiropractors that were not so much along the lines of the straight chiropractic. I mean, what I've evolved into is kind of what you're saying, Urson, which is that I don't believe that things are static. So when a chiropractor says that a bone is subluxed and a joint is out of place, that implies kind of a static positioning of something. And the same thing when we're talking about a pelvic obliquity, an upslip or an anterior rotation of the annulment or whatever, it implies kind of some sort of static nature to things when there's a very dynamic nature to our body and to our lives. And so I'm kind of a globalist. I actually think that the SI is one of the most underdiagnosed problems, but in no way is it in isolation. So the treatment that I would be providing would be for lumbar spine, SI, acetabulofemoral, you know, and all of the musculature around it, knowing that in my mind, all these things need to work in conjunction, not in isolation.
Right.
Joe, what were we going to say?
So what's causing the change in the tone, Urson, if it's not the mobilization or manipulation that you're doing?
No, the mobilization and the manipulation are changing tone, you know, via, it's not due to movement or positioning of bones, I should say. Movement of bones, osteokinematic versus arthrokinematic movement of bones can absolutely change tone. Same thing with needling or soft tissue work or, you know, all those things are inputs, and then you change the perception of stretch, or you modulate, you know, neuromodulate the pain, and that decreases tone and it alters motor control once the pain perception or the stretch perception is altered with movement. It's just that the position isn't changed. And I don't like to think that I'm doing an SI technique. I just think basically I'm pushing on this, or I'm scraping this, or I'm needling this with the outcome of changing movement and function, not changing position. You know, I just don't think I'm...
But you're reestablishing a normal joint arthrokinematic movement.
Yeah, but I don't even think arthrokinematics, because to me, I don't do glides anymore. I only do, like, large tissue patterning with ISTM.
Do you agree that joints move?
I agree that joints move. It's just that I don't think it matters, like, if you do a distraction versus an inferior glide versus a posterior glide. I think they're all going to do the same thing.
So you're not specific in your technique and the direction of the joint
angles. I don't think it matters anymore. No, I gave it up a long time ago because I just realized I didn't need to do it.
Now, have you found a better outcome with a certain technique versus another?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I'm biased toward ISTM, but I think needlers will have the same effect. Like, basically, a lot of people who got into needling, they stopped manipulating and mobilizing as much. Is that true? Right? Would you say that?
No.
No.
Not for me. Okay. No, I mean, I think some people do, because you know why? those people are the ones that get into something, and that's their thing that just fixes everything. It's their cure-all, right? Oh, I do needling, so I don't need anything else. Well, what did you do before that you had good outcomes?
Yeah, I agree with Bart on this. Because after I learned needling, I was doing it, and I still do, but I never let myself just needle people. You know, it's a means to an end. Just like the SI manipulation, it's a means to an end. You know, piece it together.
I just look at them all as inputs, you know, and of course my thing is ISTM, but I do neurodynamics and I still manipulate when I need to, just that I found that the lighter I did ISTM and the broader patterns I did, like instead of just scraping along one area, I would scrape along the entire radial nerve, or, you know, from the cervical spine all the way up and down like the median nerve container. And instead of just doing something like a friction massage to a small painful area. And I just think when we change the potentially cortically smudged image in the CNS with some light scraping and just give awareness to an area that maybe was smudged due to a lack of movement, altered motor control or pain or all of this above what the fMRI say in pain science, I just think that, you know, I noticed that when I went to go back and check joint play, what I thought was a lack of bone movement was really just tone kind of pushing back at you. So, you know, I stopped doing passive accessory testing because I just didn't find that whatever I thought was bone pushing back at me or resistance of bone moving was really just tone. Because it was, you know, the higher tone there is, the more resistance you're going to get when you push on it. So if you reduce tone, I just found I didn't need to do oscillations or manipulations nearly as much. So that's just my bias, though. And everyone, whatever treatment you use the most and you can explain the best, you're still going to have the best outcomes with.
Right. And I kind of agree with that to some extent. I think it's because I still use IASTM probably more than kneeling at this point. Still do both again, but it's, I guess it's patient presentation and just seeing how the patient is, because I think with needling, there's a lot more psychology than most other things, even manipulation that goes involved into it. It's not always the most comfortable technique. It's very effective at what it does with trigger points. And I've developed kind of an understanding of certain patients when palpating or talking to them when they come in, and you know what these trigger points feel like, and you kind of have, you know, a clinical pattern in your head of what you perceive the outcomes to be, which is a bias in itself, but it's also, you know, what experience is based on.
Right. It's a tough sell, needling. You know, no one's ever said like, wow, I love needles.
It isn't. It's, I don't know. Again, I think everybody has their own way of needling. But when I do it first, I try to stick to no more than 3 trigger points and kind of keep it to a smaller area. And to see how people respond. And, you know, just, again, it comes back to patient education, right? Kind of telling them what to expect and being honest with them. It's, I don't know about you guys, one of my biggest pet peeves when I go see a physician or some kind of medical professional or anybody, and they say, this isn't going to hurt, right before they do something that is excruciatingly painful. My dentist used to do this all the time, you know, getting the back there. He's like, oh, don't worry about it, this is not going to hurt. And then he just hits a nerve ending. And at that point, I want to take that, whatever he's scraping my teeth with, and put him on the table and do that to him and tell him, does that hurt? You know, it's, you lose all credibility. So just being honest with the person, saying this is what it's going to feel like.
Well, I think when we also think about our position as physical therapists and the healthcare team and what we can do with our patients, given the reality that we have a lot of one-on-one time with them, we have a lot of time to bond, you know, to really kind of at times become friends with our patients, more so than a lot of the other professionals, if not all the other professionals. We have to consider that and be aware of that. I mean, last night I was talking to a potential patient that is, she's 37 years old. She has hip dysplasia, and next week she's getting a hip replaced. Active, healthy, 37-year-old, and she's had 5 opinions, and all 5 of them said, I know you're 37, but you need to get your hip replaced. And so I asked her, what's your expectation of better? You know, what do you think it's going to be? And she gives me this thing like, okay, so I think I can go back to work in 2 weeks. That's what, you know, that's what I've told. And she's essentially a you know, office worker. And I said, okay, and what about good? Like, when do you think you're going to be what you would define as good? And she says, well, you know, everything I've researched and according to the surgeon, I should be good to go at like 4 to 6 months. And I said, so does that mean no pain? You can do everything you want? What? And she says, yeah, I think that's basically it. You know, and the surgeon just perpetuates this because he doesn't – she said she had a conversation with him about it. And he doesn't do anything different. He doesn't do anything to help guide her in terms of real expectations, like you were just mentioning, Jane. You know, I told her, at least in my experience – I don't know what you guys have, but in my experience – it's in that type of surgery, it's a year until you can wake up and almost forget that you had surgery. You know, forget that, okay, you don't wake up and, oh my God, my hip's stiff. Oh my goodness, I just, you know, I can't sit in the car and drive to work, whatever it is. And then your goal is that in 2 years, you forget which hip you had it done on.
Yeah, you know, I was at a conference once. I can't remember which one, but it was one of the speakers was Dr. Wilkins, who's a surgeon for the Orioles. And, you know, he gave his presentation. It was, you know, very generic presentation that you give at a basic conference. But one of the things he said, for some reason, stuck with me after years now. It's he put up a slide and he said, I fix the structural problem. Physical therapists fix the functional problems. And that was pretty much the epitome of our relationship of the surgeon and us. When patients come to me and they complain about, oh yeah, I saw the surgeon and he saw me for 30 seconds and that was it. And I asked them, what do you expect? You know, that he did or she did their job. Their job was to fix what you came them to see for, the structural problem. You're here with me now to fix whatever else is needs to be fixed and correct and the compensations and all that stuff. So it's it's managing expectations, and it's letting people know exactly what is to be expected. And like you said, Bart, asking them what their expectations are. And sometimes their expectations are what they are because they don't know any better. Sometimes they have the expectation because it's the lowest expectation, and it's on to us to fix that. But our episode of Nothing turned into a whole lot of somethings, including a lot of running. But Joe, since this is your birthday, why don't you send us out with your closing thoughts?
For the most part, that is what I tell my patients, Bart, is to expect it to be a year. But I've lately seen a lot more of anterior lateral hip replacements that are doing it a lot quicker. But the point being that if you tell somebody a year and they are doing well in 6 months, they're going to think you're the greatest person ever. If you tell somebody 6 months and it takes them a year, they're bad-mouthing you to all their family and everybody that they know.
Under-promise and oversell.
Must be why surgeons always say 2 to 3 years for all spinal fusions. And well, yeah, 2 to 3 years. Too, 2 to 3 years.
From patients.
I mean, why not? Why wouldn't you? I mean, you need to be realistic, but why wouldn't you give them the benefit of the doubt and say something longer?
That's a good point.
In terms of realism, I also like to be – I sugarcoat everything because, you know, I'm an avid follower of pain science. So one of my favorite studies basically looked at all the different factors in the longitudinal study of total knee replacements, you know, what factors predicted the best outcomes or poor outcomes. And, you know, we looked at range of motion and prior function and strength and, you know, all these factors. So basically what predicted poor outcomes for consistently what we just fear for voice and lungs and, you know, what had nothing to do with strength or prior function or range of motion. So that's why a lot of the pain science guys are making all these programs and coming out with all these books like, you know, your brain is having back surgery. Because when you prepare someone prehab-wise for surgery and tell them what to expect. But yeah, be realistic about it, but tell them, yeah, there's no reason why they can't get back to full function, as opposed to some of these messages that a surgeon and even some clinicians have told, like, oh, you're never going to run again, or you're never going to ski again. I mean, you know, just telling them that everything is basically going to be okay, but it may take time. But, you know, I do, and I wouldn't necessarily say it's sugarcoating, but I just want to be overwhelmingly positive and tell them that there is light at the end of the tunnel.
Right.
But yeah, I agree with you, Urson. I mean, there's very few things that irritate me more than someone coming in saying, well, my surgeon told me I can't run ever again, or I can't play basketball, or I can't do this ever again. And we're not here to badmouth surgeons. It's not about that. But I think, as Gene said, it's the structure versus the function. Again, running has never been proven to cause knee problems. Bad running is probably what's causing knee problems. But I think my closing thoughts, what I love about this is that, you know, between Joe and Gene and Urson and me, we all have slightly different viewpoints, slightly different views on the way we assess a patient, and whether it's Mackenzie for lower back pain that's for damn sure. Whether it's Mackenzie for low back pain, or if it's a Jax's technique, or muscle energy, pelvic obliquity, or just a pure straight on manipulation. I mean, the reality is we all are doing the things that we want to do that helps our patient the best. And the only advice I really give to young people is, first get out there. Don't worry about learning new techniques right away. Learn how to be a better diagnostician. Learn how to understand what you're seeing, which kind of goes back to my beginning thing, that with patient that I'm treating her glute min and thought it was her TFL. I should have known, based on the referral pattern, based on what she had, that it was her glute min. I just didn't. And I just needed to be better and have more patient experience and maybe some didactic experience in a continuing education setting to learn more about that, and then start to learn more techniques to be able to apply that too. And at that point, then you can add more tools to your toolbox and have more in your arsenal to be able to help patients. And some days you might find that it's Mackenzie, and some days it's instrument assisted, and some days it's needles, and some days it's positive reinforcement.
Just keep learning.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. All the tools in the world are kind of useless if you don't know how to use them. So yeah, I agree with that. I think a clinical reasoning is the best thing that you can learn out of the box.
Agreed. All right, so good show, everyone. Thank you, Dr. B, for joining us again. Joe, thank you for taking the time out of your birthday to commit your knowledge to the podcast of nothing.
Y'all have a good night.
You
Happy
too.
Happy birthday, Joe.
All right,
Happy birthday, Joe. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Let us know what you thought of the episode, what else you want to hear. And for God's sake.
Oh, by
sake,
the way, Urson was complaining. So hold on. Urson was complaining that we don't get enough feedback on the podcast. So respond to blogs and respond to podcasts. And thank
on Twitter.
You for all of you are.
Even if you're a short character word, just reply on Twitter. Let us know what you think. We had an awesome comment on our website for the last podcast. So that was great. And for God's sake, will somebody please comment and tell me the most important joint for a runner? Just give me an answer. That's all I ask.
He doesn't even know the answer. He wants an answer.
Listen to the previous podcast. There is an answer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you guys next time.